It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at some new firearms legislation getting bipartisan support in Wisconsin.
First, a look at the world of conspiracy theories. Our next guest has a new book out on the subject, and he's not trying to prove or debunk conspiracies, but to figure out what they tell us about American culture and history.
Jesse Walker joins us now. He's books editor at Reason Magazine. His new book is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Well, conspiracy theories often get lumped in with people on the fringes of the political system, often the far left or far right or unmeasurable. But you say they're more mainstream than we think. Why?
Well, I think if you look at American history from the beginning of European settlement to today, you'll find that conspiracy theories have been a potent force in the center as well as on the far left and the far right. It's not just powerless people who have conspiracy theories, it's powerful people. And I think you'll also find that even when a conspiracy theory doesn't say anything that's true about the subjects of the theory, it says something true about the anxieties and the experiences of the people who embrace it and pass it along. So whether you're talking about a mainstream or a fringe conspiracy theory, you're taking a look at something that says something about the way that folks who believe it live.
As we said right off the bat, you're not in your book looking to argue for or against any of the conspiracy theories that you talk about, but to study them. Tell us more. What, when we start to delve into these things, the ones that seem outlandish, the ones that the mainstream bought, what do we learn about ourselves, about those anxieties you mentioned?
Well, I mean, I could give you a couple of examples. I mean, if someone believes that there is a cabal plotting to impose a one-world government, new world order, and not using new world order in the sort of broad sense of more centralized control, but of actual plot of a small group of people trying to erase people's liberty and sovereignty. That speaks to people who see liberty and sovereignty as slipping away in different ways, and who feel that they're losing control over their lives. Or another example would be, you may remember in the 1980s, stories going around that white doctors were injecting black babies with AIDS. Now, that's not true, obviously. It would be irresponsible for me to claim that was true. But what is true is that there's a long history of, high-handed and abusive treatment of black patients by the white medical establishment, including some things like the Tuskegee experiment that could be described as conspiracies of a sort. And in that context, it becomes easier for a story like that to catch on and sort of to take that reason for fear or reason for resentment and make it into an external enemy with a name.
And a couple more examples you talk about that did, as you mentioned earlier, sweep into the mainstream, not just the fringes. Again, in the 80s, fears of satanic messages in our rock and roll music, backwards masking and things like that, that ended up at the U.S. Senate, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the satanic cult panic of the 1980s was taken very seriously in the mass media. It was taken seriously by people in government. There were people who went to jail and were later exonerated because they were allegedly had allegedly been a part of satanic ritual abuse. And looking back now, the whole thing seems insane. I discuss in detail an episode of the show 2020, which claims to be the sort of balanced look at the satanic network in the United States and allegations back and forth. In fact, they didn't interview a single skeptical voice, or if they did, they didn't put them on camera. They have dubious people making dubious claims again and again on the show. But it was taken seriously. Now, 15 years later, would a show like that have made it to the air? No, because that moment had passed. But it's important to remember, this was something that seized the mainstream and had everyday middle-of-the-road people embracing it.
And you use the phrase moral panic to talk mm-hmm. about that and a number of other examples. What is that?
Well, moral panic, I mean, that's a term for sociology. I mean, from sociology, it's generally associated with Stanley Cohen, who didn't coin the phrase, but he set up sort of the standard progression of it. And it's kind of a situation in which a social crisis is identified by people in the sort of the opinion molders of society, And, you know, the alarm is raised, and often he calls a folk devil takes the blame for it. And the folk devil often takes the form of a conspiracy. It might be a satanic cult, a powerful gang, a white slavery ring, a militia. And what happens is that it's what makes it a moral panic as opposed to just a social problem is that the problem is either greatly exaggerated or not really existent in the first place. And also that it leaves some sort of residue, you know, in the law or in social institutions. And so, you know, one example of this was to be 100 years ago, the white slavery panic, which was this idea of sort of vast networks of pimps, essentially, coercing people into prostitution. And, of course, you know, coerced prostitution did exist, but it was neither as organized nor as prevalent as this rhetoric, which, you know, often had, you know, I quote one book which talks about it as like the invisible force, you know, pulling the strings of the government, and that's why these people aren't locked up and so on. But, you know, it made the Mann Act the law. It gave a big boost in power to what was then known as the Bureau of Investigation, later known as the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And it has, I mean, some of the claims about sex trafficking today are echoes of the old white slavery panic. And again, you hear vast conspiracies being invoked that probably don't exist.
You mentioned militias a few moments ago, and that's another one I had wanted to talk about. A big reaction against fears of conservative or right-wing, whichever phrase people are using, militias, especially after the Oklahoma City bombing in the 90s. Can you talk through that story?
Sure. I mean, the Oklahoma City bomb, I mean, in general, in the 1990s, when people talk about militias and conspiracies, they talk about the conspiracy theories that people in the militias believed, right? And that's obviously a valid thing to look at. And I mean, I mentioned New World Order theories. You know, that's part of the story. But there were also this exaggerated fear of the militias themselves, especially after the Oklahoma City bombing. In fact, Timothy McVeigh was not a member of a militia. There were about a dozen plots, terror plots that were traced to, you know, people that you might call militiamen, generally in sort of small splinter groups that had been kicked out of larger militia groups, and often they came to light because other militiamen found out what these guys were plotting and informed the authorities. So it was another example of a social threat being greatly exaggerated, and a set of people being treated as scapegoats or as sort of the exaggerated folk devil that's being blamed for the situation.
Whether we're talking about the satanic conspiracy or this fear of militias or the more, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy theories, all those things, why do some of us, or in some cases a lot of us, get caught up in these?
Well, conspiracy theories are inevitable. Conspiracy theories emerge because you've got three things colliding. And first of all, human beings naturally seek patterns. We naturally create narratives. We take all the signals that are coming onto our radar screen, and we edit them. I'm mixing metaphors here. And we edit them into a coherent story. That's just how we make sense of the world around us. Number two, people have reasons to be afraid. People are suspicious of other groups. People are in a fearful situation. So when you put those two together, you naturally come up with narratives that are fearful narratives, and that often involve conspiracies, especially because of factor number three, which is that people do conspire. There are real conspiracies in the world. If you read the news, you know, every few years, something big will come out that makes people say, aha, they're up to something. Now let me imagine what else they might be up to. So you put those three things together, you're always going to have people engaging in conspiratorial thinking. I think that just about anyone who's not in a coma has engaged in some sort of conspiratorial thinking. It's not that there's one particular group or two particular groups of Americans that are, you know, susceptible to this. I think it's just part of being a human being.
We're talking about conspiracy theories with Jesse Walker. His new book is The United States of Paranoia. We're going to get into some of the pop culture views of conspiracy theories in just a few minutes.
And we want to hear from you. Why do you think conspiracy theories catch on, and what do they tell us about our society? Are you a fan of conspiracy theories in pop culture, maybe the X-Files, Dan Brown novels? You can call us or email. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. Coming up, a look at a gun control bill in Wisconsin with bipartisan support.
Now we'll continue our conversation with Jesse Walker, author of The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. We'll get to your calls in just a few moments at 800-642-1234. Why do you think people find conspiracy theories appealing? It's 800-642-1234. Jesse, I mentioned I wanted to turn to pop culture and conspiracy theories. Two things I wanted to get to. First, you talk about conspiracy theory rising as a hobby these days. Talk about that.
Yeah, or sort of as a leisure activity. I mean, there's been in the sort of a rise of a self-conscious conspiracy subculture. I mean, people who are just interested in conspiracies, and sometimes it's very sincere and earnest, and they're just, but it's different from other conspiracy theorists in that they're deliberately mixing elements from, you know, the left, the right, libertarians, what have you. And then there's also the what I call the ironic style of conspiracy thinking, which is people who just want to, they don't want to believe or debunk conspiracy theories so much as they just want to play with them, mine them for laughs, metaphors, social insights, maybe build big elaborate conspiracy theories of their own, not to believe, but to, you know, just create something that's expressive. And I talk about ways that this, you know, has had an influence on, you know, stuff ranging from gaming to, you know, just pranks. And that's a substantial part of the latter half of the book.
And you mentioned wanting to believe, and the X-Files, popular is the phrase, I want to believe. That was one of the big conspiracy theory shows in pop culture. Was there a big wave of that sort of thing, and why?
Well, in the 1990s, they were sort of a golden age. I have this sort of typology of conspiracy theories. I talk about the enemy above, the enemy below, the enemy outside, the enemy within, and then also something called the benevolent conspiracy, which is, doesn't involve an enemy at all. And I say that the 1990s and also the 1970s were both golden ages of enemy above stories. And in the 1990s, there was this, I mean, in for a number of reasons, in part the end of the Cold War, so that suspicions that previously were going outward were now heading, you know, inward, partly because of, you know, the rise of the internet and the way that just affected the ability of these stories to mix and so on. There was this real rise in both overt, you know, theories that people believed that involved, you know, the enemy above, and also stories like the X-Files, where it was in popular culture, people were not believing them, but they were enjoying these stories and being influenced by them. And the X-Files, in turn, drew on all the stories people were, you know, telling out in this folklore that I write about in the book. In fact, I say The X-Files was a show that was sort of so capacious and how many anxieties it could cover that it managed to have episodes that both expressed the conspiracy theories of the militias and expressed the fear of the militias. So getting back to what you were asking about earlier, you know, the X-Files was able to absorb both and much else besides.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Gail on the line in Door County. Hi there, Gail.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have I'm listening here, and I'm recalling where we have had a lot of what would be called conspiracy theories from the past that have actually come to fruition and have actually happened. Surveillances where the Berlin Wall would be coming down, and we would have a new enemy created, where we kind of start to fall into better relations with Russia, and we would have to have a new enemy to have to work against, and that rose about 3 years later with some Middle East issues. So we've had a lot of what were deemed conspiracy theories back even from the 60s and 70s that have actually happened now with even the surveillances that are going on now. and the reductions of freedoms and the challenges to the Constitution and all these things where people were told when they were talking about this, they were all, you know, just was just crazy talk, and it's actually all happening now.
Thanks for the call, Gail. So conspiracy theory is not spun from whole cloth. What do you think, Jesse?
Well, like I said, people do conspire. I mean, I'm not sure that I would describe the discovery of a new enemy as a conspiracy. I think it's more of sort of just a social evolution. Institutions need enemies, and they find them without necessarily planning to create one. But I have a whole chapter that gets into the investigations of the 1970s, not just, you know, after Watergate, the Church Committee and other committees in Congress and Washington exposing misdeeds in the CIA, the FBI, NSA, IRS, that, you know, that really did happen. And I talk, first of all, about, you know, the genuine misbehavior, making it clear that there are, you know, real conspiracies in the world, but also talking about how this then influenced popular culture, how it lowered the bar for what other sorts of conspiracies that maybe were more dubious people could imagine because of what had been and was now demonstrably true, and how it all just sort of affected the way that people discussed politics.
Thanks for the call, Gail. We now have James in Rice Lake. James, hi.
How's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think about this?
Well, the conspiracy, I think it's so popular just because there's so many, it's so interesting. It's kind of takes away from the regular 9-to-5 grind and kind of inspires that imagination to where, you know, I think it's almost a dynamic of people where they want to believe in something, you know, outside of, you know, normal, you know, everyday blandness, I guess, if you will, to where, you know, it's like Sasquatch or, you know, things like those where people are like, ah, what if, you know, what if, and it really gives them something to, you know, kind of hang on to and even pursue in some cases.
That's interesting. Thanks a lot for bringing that up. So, Jesse, the conspiracy theory, whether you believe it, play with it, don't believe it, it makes the world a more interesting place.
Sure. I think, I mean, obviously there are lots of conspiracy theorists that is not why they believe or get interested. But I think there's plenty that is. I mean, that sort of gets to what you were asking me about earlier, about it being kind of a hobby or a leisure activity. In a way, you know, I wrote this book, you know, and aware that, you know, part of the audience is going to be people who enjoy reading about conspiracy theories. You know, they say, oh, look, in the 19th century, this person thought there was a conspiracy behind the deaths of William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor. I didn't know those presidents had conspiracy theories to them. So, yeah, I think the caller's right.
Thanks a lot for the call. Matt is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I was thinking that with certain people, conspiracy theories are sort of a defense mechanism for their idealism, and that instead of, you know, the state, the unsatisfying parts of the world being the product of just human decision-making, there must be some sort of force or effort or enemy to produce these unsatisfying or disheartening conditions. It can't be just because that's the way what happens when people behave self-interestedly.
Got it. Thanks a lot, Matt. So the world wouldn't be this bad from my perspective if it weren't for a cabal, a force guiding it in that direction. Is that a common theme, Jesse?
That is a theme in many conspiracy theories. Again, you can't reduce, and I don't think the caller was trying to reduce all conspiracy theorizing to that, but I've certainly, there is this drive to take a social force and turn it into an external enemy with a name. It's sort of like the way an animist would treat a natural force as a god. You know, this would be treating a social force as a conspiracy. Although I should say, there's also the opposite. I mean, there are people who enjoy conspiracy theories because they like to live in a confusing, they like to imagine sort of a confusing world where you don't know, you know what is actually going on. They like piling mysteries on top of other mysteries. I think that kind of gets to what the other caller was saying about people, you know, in treating it as this hobby, as to use the word that you used.
Jesse, just in a few seconds, a brief answer. You focused on the United States. Do you think there have been conspiracies everywhere throughout time? Are we Americans really more into conspiracies than anybody else?
Oh, I doubt it. I mean, obviously, there's lots of conspiracy theories in, you know, the Middle East, Latin America, Russia, and so on. And for all I know, the Norwegians are just terrified of everything. I wrote about the United States not because I think that we're more paranoid than other people, but because this is basically my way of looking at American history. It's a, what is the grand panoramic vision that we get if we look at the history of what people have been afraid of? And what people have believed in that is fearful.
Jesse,
someone could write a great version of it for Europe.
Jesse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Going out with the X-Files theme here, that was Jesse Walker, books editor at Reason Magazine. His book is The United States of Paranoia.
Coming up, we'll hear about bipartisan support for gun control legislation in Wisconsin. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says that 50 years after the March on Washington, it's time to start marching again.
First, though, we're going to take a look at gun laws in Wisconsin.
In today's political climate, laws that deal with guns often split people across party lines.
This may not be the case, though, for a new proposal by State Senator Alberta Darling.
After speaking with law enforcement officials in Milwaukee, the senator is now drafting a bill that would enact harsher penalties for those who possess firearms illegally.
And our guest Bill Leader says that support for the measure could be bipartisan. Bill is the Money and Politics Project Manager for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, thanks for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the bill. What measures does it include as it's being drafted so far?
Well, the bill is in drafting, so by definition, we can't see exactly what is in it yet. But what the chief of police of Milwaukee, Edward Flynn, has asked for, and he has been working with Senator Darling and her staff in the drafting of this bill, is increase the penalties, create a mandatory 3-year prison term for anyone who qualifies as a habitual offender and commits a gun violation, a gun-related violation. So an habitual offender under state statute is anyone who has one felony conviction or at least 3 separate misdemeanor convictions within the prior 5-year period. If someone who has that criminal history is caught in illegal possession of a firearm, this would trigger a mandatory 3-year term.
And one of the unusual things about this bill as it's being drafted so far is that it seems to have, in Wisconsin, an unusual amount of bipartisan support. Tell us about that.
Well, the bill is something that Edward Flynn, the police chief of Milwaukee, has wanted for a long time. It's also supported by Tom Barrett, who, of course, the office of Milwaukee is a nonpartisan office, but Tom Barrett is clearly a Democrat since he ran as a Democrat against Scott Walker for governor. But the governor, Scott Walker, has said that he is open to the idea of increasing penalties on people who commit gun-related offenses, so long as this does not interfere with the rights of law-abiding citizens. He said that he is all for that. As we've mentioned, the bill is being introduced by a Republican state senator. I would assume that it would have bipartisan support. That is what Joel Plant, the chief of staff of the Milwaukee Police Department, told me. There is some sense among Democrats that they want to make the case that this type of legislation isn't all that needs to be done, that we really need to get a better system of background checks in place in the state of Wisconsin. That's a bill that the Democrats have introduced and backed, and they responded to Darling's bill by saying, well, why don't you pass this instead? But I think when it comes down to it, with the support of Tom Barrett and with the support of the chief of police of Milwaukee, the Democrats are going to support this bill as it's been introduced by a Republican.
Now, Mayor Barrett and Governor Walker have been at odds a lot. There's been a lot of sallies going back and forth the past year or so. Does this represent an olive branch at all, or is this just a piece of legislation that's a no-brainer for people?
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I think there will be people who won't like the idea of a law that creates a mandatory sentence, both because mandatory minimums are controversial in and of themselves and because it represents a crackdown of sorts against guns, and it's going to have some lack of spy. I did talk to someone or communicate with someone, I should say, with Wisconsin Carry Incorporated, an organization that supports concealed carry, who is pretty cool to the idea of new legislation restricting guns. So I don't know that it will have universal support. It is extraordinary that Tom Barrett and Scott Walker would agree on anything. In fact, one of the points I made in the column is if you Google the first three words of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel headline on the story that reported this, the first three words are Walker, Barrett agree. Type that into Google, and that story will come right up.
It's the one thing that comes
that's
up.
That's the only time those three words have ever appeared together on the internet.
Maybe the last. We'll have to see about that. Yeah, so this could be a sea change, but it could be that, you know, it's an interesting time in Milwaukee's history, too. Now, tell us a little bit about what occasioned this bill to come about.
Well, the Senator Darling proposed this in early August, right around the time that Milwaukee saw a spate of gun violence. During a one-week period in early August, there were 23 people shot in the city of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Of them died from their wounds. It was something that got the attention of the senator, and she said that her proposal was in part a response to that. And, of course, the police chief of Milwaukee has been saying for a long time that he needs more tools to deal with the problem of habitual criminals who get guns and who are able to continue to possess guns no matter how often they get arrested, because most of the time the offenses are not going to put them away for a good long time.
Now, is this seen as a tweak to existing legislation, or is this seen as more significant than that?
I would think that it's more significant because it creates a mandatory minimum. It would have a significant fiscal cost, I would imagine. I mean, if you you look at the reaction to this, was also proposed by Alberta Darling, the toughening of state drunk driving laws, that comes with a considerable fiscal cost because you're locking up people for lengths of time that it's going to put additional pressures on the prison system. So I think it's significant as a piece of legislation.
Can you give us a sense of what other gun related legislation might be in the pike here in Wisconsin besides this?
Well, there are a few things that gun supporters have wanted, and those bills appear to be advancing. Of course, we've heard about the crossbow, the expanded use of crossbow. That is backed by gun lobby groups, the National Rifle Association, Wisconsin Gun Owners, Inc. They support that measure, and that has moved forward. There is a bill that would eliminate the restrictions that are currently in place on hunting with a bow and arrow near schools and hospitals. There are certain local rules that would be eliminated with that statute. And there's another provision that would exempt bird hunting preserves from noise nuisance laws that the NRA and other gun groups are supporting. So there are a number of things that are kind of tangentially related to the issue of guns and weapons that are moving forward. There are also a number of bills that the Democrats have introduced which don't appear to be moving forward. The most important in their mind is to toughen the rules for background checks so that every gun sold, or most every gun sold in the state of Wisconsin, would require some sort of background check to see if the person is legally prohibited from buying that weapon now at gun shows and in private sales.
You said that was not moving forward.
That is not going anywhere. That was introduced in April. It has not had a hearing. It has not had any sort of committee action. There's also a Democrat-backed bill that would ban assault weapons and large-capacity magazines, another bill to deal with hollow-point bullets and other kinds of ammunition, and a bill that would ban concealed weapons in the Capitol, which has been allowed since the passage of the concealed carry law. None of that legislation appears to be moving forward.
Interesting, but this one piece does look promising, I guess, on its bipartisan legs.
Yeah, I think that, because Republicans control the legislature and because the governor has indicated his support, it's likely to have a good, strong chance of becoming law in the state. I get the sense from the little I was able to learn from the position of the gun groups, they may not be fully supported of this. And as I said, the Democrats are going to say, well, you know, why aren't you backing some of these other measures? If you really want to address this issue, these are the things that we think ought to be done. And we're going to hear that argument raised again.
What do you see as the next step? It's in drafting right now. What comes after this?
The bill should come under drafting in the next couple of weeks, as I understand it, and then it will be introduced to the legislature, assigned to a committee. Presumably, it will be scheduled for hearings, and then anyone with an opinion on the bill will have the chance to weigh in. Then the committee that holds the hearing will make a recommendation, whether its members support or oppose it, and make that recommendation to the legislature. And it can either be referred to another committee or scheduled for a vote. And then, of course, to become law, it has to pass both houses and be signed by the governor.
No, it's probably a stretch, but should the bill go forward, it's going to please Mayor Barrett. It looks like it would please Governor Walker. Are we looking at a new era of cooperation a little bit, maybe?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I would like to think so. I think it's good for the state when politicians can make common cause. I mean, irrespective of what the issue is, I'm not saying that this is good legislation or bad legislation, but we can certainly say that bipartisan cooperation is a rare thing in the state of Wisconsin, and that this would be an example of that happening.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
Very good to be here.
Bill Leader's with us today. He's Money and Politics Project Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
Now we'll take a look at the headlines. Then we'll hear why our next guest says 50 years out, it's time we march on Washington again.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Today is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March on Washington, and people gathered today in the nation's capital to remember that event. Our next guest says the issues raised in that original march are very much still with us, and he wants to see a revival of large-scale protest.
Ari Berman joins us. He's contributing writer for The Nation magazine. Ari, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you covered a march this last weekend, and then you were at today's commemoration event. Did you get a sense that it was a celebration without much current political content, or were people thinking, hey, we've got a lot of unfinished business here?
It was definitely the latter. If you looked at the rally on Saturday, it was really all about the unfinished progress of the civil rights movement. It was about the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in June and what has happened since in states with new voting restrictions being passed. It was about the killing of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman. Trayvon Martin's face was really omnipresent at that rally. It was about stop and frisk in New York City and what they viewed as wide-scale racial profiling. It was about the black unemployment rate being twice the white unemployment rate right now, nearly the same ratio as in 1963. So for all those reasons, it really wasn't a commemoration. It was, I would say, much more of a continuation or a call to action. And even today, as Presidents Obama, Clinton, and Carter spoke, they talked about the tremendous progress that we've made since 1963, but they definitely talked about these issues, whether it's voting rights, criminal justice, or the economy, that really are still very much unfulfilled today.
Do you think that the movement is out there, that there's a civil rights movement out there strong enough nowadays to recreate something as powerful as the 1963 march and all the other protests and boycotts around the country that we saw in the early 60s?
So it's very different because obviously there's been so much progress that there doesn't need to be the kind of civil rights movement that there was in the 1960s. In the 1960s, if you look at the states of the old Confederacy, African Americans were almost wholly disenfranchised. Today there's a black president. So no one is arguing that 2013 is like 1963, but it's also true, for example, in places like North Carolina where they've just passed the country's toughest new voting restriction, or you look at Florida with the Stand Your Ground law. There's clearly a need for a new wave of civil rights activism, and we are seeing more grassroots groups emerge. I've written about this for The Nation, but in North Carolina, for example, we have the Moral Monday movement, which has been compared to the movement we saw in Wisconsin that fought for working rights, but basically a multi-issue, multiracial grassroots movement that's fighting on a number of fronts. In Florida, we have the Dream Defenders, a group of young activists who began a sit-in after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, spent a month in the Capitol calling for the repeal of Stand Your Ground, and are now going to try to register 60,000 voters, which was the margin of victory of Florida Governor Rick Scott, who is now up for re-election next year. So I do think we're seeing the seeds of a new civil rights movement. I don't think we can really say there's a national civil rights movement like there was in 1963, but I think there is a new wave of activism in response to some of the recent things we've seen in this country.
Is public protest, the kind of things you're talking about, is that relevant still in 2013? Is it the right platform, the right format to raise these issues?
I think when people feel frustrated with the political process, that's when they start taking to public protest. So you saw that in Wisconsin, right? When people felt like they didn't have a voice in the legislature, they decided to sit in the legislature so that people would pay attention in Wisconsin and they could try to force change in that state. I think the same thing happened in North Carolina. Republicans took over state government in North Carolina for the first time in over 100 years. They passed what Democrats and progressives down there viewed as a host of really, really radical policies on pretty much every single issue. People felt like their voices weren't being heard in the political process, so they had to go in, they had to sit in the state legislature, they had to get arrested, do the kind of nonviolent civil disobedience that happened in the 1960s to dramatize what was going on in the state. And if you look at what's happened, for example, in North Carolina, the legislature and the governor down there are very unpopular right now, and the protesters are quite a bit more popular. So that doesn't mean that it's all because of the protests, but the protests have shifted attention onto these issues. And then I think the next step is you take it from the protests, from the streets, into the electoral process. And I think the goal here, I think these activists hope, is that they'll have an impact on the 2014 elections and the 2016 elections, then the political process will be more responsive to their concerns.
Well, and does that work, though? I mean, in Wisconsin, you mentioned the protests, and then there was a recall election, and the governor won. He viewed that as an endorsement of his policies. The big protest didn't, at least in the short run, sway much of anything in the electoral process.
Well, they got people energized. They ultimately were unsuccessful at the electoral sphere, but they got people energized, and they encouraged protests elsewhere as well. So it's very possible that what's happening in North Carolina wouldn't have happened without Wisconsin going first. So I don't want to argue that it's something that always works, because clearly it doesn't. But I also think we don't know if it's going to work, because certainly there's the whole question of what will happen in the 2014 election. But just if you look at the numbers, for example, in North Carolina, the numbers of the legislature, the numbers of the governor down there, they have fallen sharply since the Moral Monday protests began.
Moving from the tactics of protests, I want to get more into some of the issues that you think have persisted since 1963. You mentioned voting rights. You mentioned the Trayvon Martin shooting as something that energized a lot of people. What other issues do you see brought up 50 years ago in the march that that you think we haven't solved yet, that you're hoping to see protests about?
Well, I think the whole criminal justice issue was really front and center. The mass incarceration of particularly African-American men, I think, was a very salient issue, particularly at the march and the rally on Saturday. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which mentions that there's more black men in prison today than were enslaved in 1850. The stats in that book, what's happening with the drug war, what's happening with what they call the school-to-prison pipeline, these deep structural issues are something that I think people really want to see addressed. They don't see politicians in either party really talking about it, but it's having an enormous impact on a lot of people. So I think the goal is to talk about some of the things that are obviously in the news, like Trayvon Martin, for example, but then to take a deeper look on things that are affecting millions of people every day that aren't getting discussed in the normal political debates.
That reminds me, a recent Pew survey found a lot of concern about civil rights in the United States. Fewer than half of Americans say there's been substantial progress made, and most black Americans say they're treated less fairly by police, courts, and other institutions. Does that surprise you to hear that?
Well, there's a very interesting disconnect between public opinion, particularly public opinion among people of color, and then the views of, for example, the conservative justices on the Supreme Court, because the court in particular is saying that these historic remedies for long-term discrimination, whether it's the Voting Rights Act or affirmative action or a fair housing case that's going to be heard next term, the Supreme Court's basically saying that we're past that, that we don't need those protections anymore. We don't need the same kind of stringent protections that we had before. And the public is saying something different, or at least parts of the public are saying something different, which is, yes, we've made a lot of progress, but these things are still very unsettled. And just look at what's happened, for example, since the Voting Rights Act decision. John Roberts in that decision basically said voting discrimination is largely a thing of the past. He didn't say totally, but he said largely a thing of the past. And since then, we've seen seven southern states pass or implement new voting restrictions that disproportionately impact people of color. And so there is this very interesting tension right now in our society between what's happening in the upper echelons of power and how people are feeling about these issues.
Before I let you go, just briefly, I mean, you've talked about what you still think needs to change. Is it worth taking time to celebrate some of the changes we've seen in the 50 years since the march?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's been happening all week. I mean, people have been celebrating President Obama. People have been celebrating Congressman John Lewis, who was the only surviving speaker there. But I think if we just celebrate it, we miss what made the movement so vital back then, and the fact that the reason to have these commemorations is not just to remember them like we're going to a museum, but to realize that these are still vital issues that we have to discuss and deal with in our society today.
Ari, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ari Berman with The Nation magazine. His piece on civil rights is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as wildfires rage in California, we'll talk to a guest who says big wildfires may be the new normal.
We will hear about the future of the Girl Scouts around the United States.
And we'll get some old school cookout tips in time for Labor Day with a look at vintage grilling recipes.
I think I'll need to pay attention to that and maybe run home and grill afterward. Well, that's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.